I'm Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center, and welcome to We the People, a weekly show of constitutional debate. The National Constitution Center is the only institution in America chartered by Congress to disseminate information about the U.S. Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. And today we will preview the upcoming Supreme Court term, which begins, as it does every year, on the first Monday of October. For those of you keeping track at home, that is Monday, October 5th. The court has already accepted a handful of headliner cases, including three we'll focus on today. Enwell versus Abbott, about the principle of one person, one vote. Friedrich versus California Teachers Association, about unions and free speech. And Fisher versus University of Texas, about affirmative action. After last term's blockbuster finish with rulings on marriage equality, the Affordable Care Act, the death penalty, and others, the court has set itself up for another exciting round of decisions, with the possibility of accepting additional cases about abortion, religious exemptions, and more. Joining me to discuss what's next at the Supreme Court are two of the country's leading constitutional commentators. Kenji Yoshino is the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at the New York University School of Law. He specializes in constitutional law, anti-discrimination law, and law and literature. Kenji's also the author of the superb new book, Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, which he discussed with me in a wonderful program here at the Constitution Center in June. You can watch it on our website at constitutioncenter.org. Josh Blackman is an associate professor of law at the South Texas College of Law. He specializes in constitutional law and the intersection of law and technology. Josh is also the author of another great book, the critically acclaimed Unprecedented, The Constitutional Challenge to Obamacare. Josh and I discussed that book at a Cato Institute forum last year, which is also online. Kenji, Josh, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
Let us begin with the one person, one vote case. And I want to make sure that I have the pronunciation correct of the title. It is Evenwell versus Abbott, unless one of you tells me that it's Evenwell. And Kenji, why don't we start with you? Can you tell me what the constitutional issues in the case are?
Sure. So since the Reynolds versus Sims case in 1964, the court has embraced the principle of one person, one vote, which essentially means that you should be representing the same number of individuals when you serve in a representative capacity. And the question that's presented in this case, which comes out of Texas, is what the denominator is when we're thinking about the population. So are we supposed to use the total population in the jurisdiction, or are we only supposed to use the eligible voters within the jurisdiction? So obviously these two approaches would lead to very different results. There's a 1966 case called Burns versus Richardson in which the court said, you know, it's really up for the state to make either choice with regard to its state representatives. And so the Supreme Court has been kind of studiously hands-off about this. But the challenge in Texas says, no, you can't use the plaintiffs there said you can't use a total population approach. You have to simply use a eligible voter approach. And the Supreme Court has mandatory appellate jurisdiction, or had to take a mandatory appeal from that case, and didn't just do a summary affirmance, but rather teed up the question of whether or not the proper way of thinking about the population was the total population or the eligible voter population.
Thank you so much, Kenji, for that great introduction to the issues. Josh, which of the positions do you find more constitutionally persuasive, the argument that the Constitution requires states to draw their districts based on registered voters or total population, and why?
So I'll admit, I'm on the fence about this case. I don't really have a strong position either way, but we start, as always, with the text of the Constitution. And the 14th Amendment says, no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction equal protection of the laws. And what does person mean in this case? And when the Supreme Court decided the Reynolds v. Sims case that Kenji mentioned a moment ago, deciding that one person, one vote, they were looking to the text of the 14th Amendment, but not all persons can vote, right? Only citizens can vote. You have to be over the age of 18 to vote. There are certain disenfranchisements for felons to vote, and all those have been upheld constitutionally. So it's not simply enough to say that all persons can vote. They have to actually decide what is a person. So there are various arguments being presented in this case, and just to take an easy one, in the state of Texas where I live, there are a significant number of non-citizens, people who are not citizens and cannot vote. Yet under the various formulas, they're counted under the total voting population. And the Evanwell plaintiffs assert that this accounting of non-citizens dilutes their vote. Because you're effectively affording more representation to districts with a larger population who cannot vote, they're diluting the vote. And this case, and I'll speak maybe for Kenji can comment, someone came out of the blue. The court hadn't really decided this issue or even had the opportunity to look at it in decades. And this case was brought for the specific purpose of teeing up the Reynolds v. Sims question. And in fact, the case here is brought by a gentleman named Edward Bloom, who also brought the Fisher case, the other case we'll be discussing later. So these were very deliberate challenges to various aspects of voting law that could have serious repercussions if the court indeed holds that the denominator, as Kenji said, must be limited to those who can vote.
Well, Kenji, let's really dig into the text and history of the Equal Protection Clause. Defenders of arguing that apportionment rather than voting population should count note that in the original Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, apportionment among the states of members of Congress was based on the number of persons rather than eligible voters. They say this supports the idea the founders intended to be apportionment based on people, not eligible or registered voters. And then there's a 14th Amendment history, too, and a very interesting brief filed by the Constitutional Accountability Center saying that the framers of the 14th Amendment, too, had in mind persons and not eligible voters. Can you tell us more about what you think of that history?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think Josh teed it up really well, and I think this is going to be a close case as well, insofar as, on the one hand, the history that you described is obviously completely accurate. So you have, you know, the body of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2. You have the framers of the 14th Amendment sort of doubling down on that principle later on when the 14th Amendment is ratified. But, you know, as Josh was saying, you know, we can say that there have been exceptions to this notion of persons. So people under 18 are persons, felons are persons, and so on and so forth. I think the only thing that might tug against that understanding is that states have long been understood to, and I don't think many people understand this, states have long been able to give non-citizens the right to vote. So it's completely within a state's power to give a non-citizen the right to vote if it so chooses. So it seems a little bit perverse to say that a state could actually give the franchise to somebody who is a non-citizen but wouldn't be allowed to count non-citizens in its denominator. But I also have to say, just as someone who's a legal realist and who takes a pretty practical approach to these cases, that I think the thing that's really going to tell here is just practice, you know, that we often sort of go by how many laws or how many practices we're going to have to upend if we come to a particular constitutional conclusion. This is what Philip Bobbitt calls the prudential modality, right? So under that kind of consequentialist reasoning, you know, the long practice has been to think about the denominator as being persons rather than eligible voters. And so I think that's going to tell. All that said, if I were to argue against myself, you know, the Hawaii case, the Burns case that I alluded to earlier, actually concerned an issue that went the other way, that the legislature made a choice going in the other direction that said we want not the total population, but simply eligible voters. So the court has allowed states to go in the other direction. But I think the point here is that the court, I believe, will ultimately come down on the side of, yes, the state gets to decide whichever way it decides. In Texas, this is decided for the total population route, and so that would be protected in the same way that Hawaii would be in making the opposite choice. If pushed to the wall with regard to whether or not which approach to take to mandate nationwide, I find it hard to believe, based on the practice point, just as much as the historical point. I think the practice point would actually tell more strongly that the court wouldn't take the total population approach.
Very interesting. Josh, you said the case came out of the blue. Why did the court take it? There was not a circuit split. I want you to help me channel the views of the justices who may have been eager to embrace a voting population and not apportionment? And then on what grounds would they so decide, given the fact that text, original understanding, and precedent seem to, or at least Kenji's argued that those favor allowing the states to decide which denominator to choose?
Right. So in 2001, there was a case called Chen v. City of Houston, which raised similar issues. And the court didn't take that case, but Justice Thomas filed a dissent from denial of certiorari, what's called a dissental, if you want to be a cool kid. And
nice.
Justice Thomas said, we need to take a case like this. So, you know, you only need four votes for certiorari. So even if there aren't five votes to reverse the lower court, there may be at least three and maybe plus one justice who had enough interest to take it, right? But the more difficult question is how to resolve this. And there have been, Jeff, you mentioned a couple, dozens of amicus briefs filed by various groups, political scientists saying, you know, here's how virtually every state in the union compiles their districting maps, right? And if the court would rule like this, you would upend, you know, a significant amount of practice. So you might say, you know, why would the Supreme Court upend a voting practice that is, you know, approved of by virtually everyone in the country? Well, the answer to that question is Shelby County v. Holder. There's the case a couple of years ago where the Supreme Court found provisions of the Voting Rights Act was unconstitutional. This was the very Voting Rights Act that had just been reauthorized by Congress by, you know, a near unanimous vote a couple of years earlier. So, frankly, the mere fact that a lot of people like this regime isn't necessarily a good indication that the court will uphold it. And Shelby County is Exhibit A in that brief.
Kenji, some have argued that a counting on the basis of eligible voters, not apportionment, would favor Republicans. And Josh mentioned that this case was brought by the guy who brought the Fisher case. Do you agree with those who say that, you know, it's an effort to favor the interests of the Republican Party, or do you think it's a principled and open constitutional question?
Well, I mean, I do think that the effect of it is going to favor Republicans overall, because what we're talking about in many jurisdictions is undocumented aliens who would have the right to be counted under one metric, the population metric, but not under the registered voter metric. So, you know, I think that's as far as I'll go in terms of saying we know what the consequence of the suit is, and I'm sure the people who are bringing the suit knew what the consequence of the suit was. With regard to the earlier point, you know, I take the point really seriously that, you know, Shelby County was certainly a revolution in the voting rights realm. But I think what's interesting about this, in distinction to Shelby County, is that the existing practice under Burns is really to respect state sovereignty. I think that one of the things that concerned the chief in Shelby County was that there's a kind of denigration of the states going on, where he said, you know, the South was not what it once was, and that it actually demeans the sovereignty of the states vis-a-vis each other to say that they're good states and bad states, or good jurisdictions and bad jurisdictions. And here, I don't really see the same kind of denigration. I'm curious to hear whether or not Josh does, but I just don't see the same degree of concern from a state sovereignty perspective. And indeed, the status quo seems to favor state sovereignty by allowing the states to choose in either direction, whether the total population approach or the eligible voter approach. So, you know, I think that one thing that would be interesting is if the court looked at Burns and said, Burns, after this many decades of the voter rights revolution, is no longer good law. But as it stands, the status quo is that the states get to choose either way.
Well, Josh, for the last word on Evanwell, can you answer Kenji's question and try to channel the conservative justices here? Might some be sympathetic to the idea that state sovereignty requires the states to choose either way? How will Justice Kennedy vote, and how will the other conservatives vote in this case?
Oh, you asked so much for me, Jeff.
I think the
short answer is this is not actually about respecting state sovereignty, but under the principle that the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, abrogates state sovereignty. Indeed, it's the exact opposite. Well, usually conservatives are pushing for stronger states' rights. Here, who's defending this but Governor Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas? It's not very often that the governor of Texas is taking these sorts of positions. Now, what is the court going to do here? I'll go with Kenji. I have no idea. I think this is a close case, and because we have so little to go on. I mean, last year we had this Arizona redistricting legislation case, and that one came out in a somewhat, you know, unexpected manner over what the phrase the legislature means in the Constitution. I think this case will have similar overtone. So I'll answer a question for other ones. I'll Justice Kennedy will vote, but not for this one. I think this one I'll leave up in the air.
Thank you for your prudence, and I'll certainly come back and ask you about Justice Kennedy on the next case, which is the memorably named Friedrich versus California Teachers Association. Josh, why don't you tell us what the issues are in this case?
Sure. So unions ain't what they used to be in this country. There was a point in this country where virtually, I think one in three employees was a member of a union. But in recent years, due to things like right-to-work laws, that number has plummeted. And one of the few bastions of strength for unions is in the public sector, for example, public school teachers. And as the court has held in a case called Abood, which is about a 30-year-old case, and some cases before that, a public employee can't be forced to be a member of the union because of some First Amendment values there. But the union can still charge a fee, what's called an agency fee, to the employee. And the purpose for the agency fee is actually quite limited. It doesn't involve any sort of political lobbying. All it involves are the costs of bargaining. And these fees have to be very accurately calculated, that the union must separate the activities for lobbying and things of that nature with actually collective bargaining, which ostensibly benefits the employee. Okay, so where are we now? This case, Abood, created that distinction, saying that as long as the fees are limited to the actual bargaining costs, the non-member can be charged this. In a number of Supreme Court decisions in the last couple of years, one of which was called Knox v. SEIU, and then Harris v. Quinn from a couple of years ago, the court, and Justice Alito in particular, has strongly hinted that the Abood decision is actually unconstitutional, that it violates the First Amendment. That is, forcing a public employee to pay a fee, effectively to subsidize a union, is forcing them to associate and subsidize speech that they don't agree with. Now, the lower courts in this case are bound by Abood, but the challengers know this. It's a bunch of California public school teachers should know this, but they are appealing this up to the Supreme Court, and the court's taken this. And Kenji can give his opinion, but if the votes in Harris v. Quinn and Knox v. SAU were what they were, there's a pretty good chance that Abood will be no more. The Abood will not abide, so to speak. And we will we'll have a situation where public sector unions can no longer compel non-members to pay anything. And this would be crippling for public sector unions because people will just be able to free ride. They'll be able to get whatever benefits the union provides and not pay any dues. And this would be a serious body blow to the labor movement.
Okay, well, thanks for setting that case up so well. So, Kenji, help our audience understand whether you think Abood should be overturned and whether it will be overturned. What did Abood rest on? Was it correctly decided in your view? And is the writing on the wall for it?
Yeah, so I do think that Abood was correctly decided because the decision really rested on the fact that there is a law that places certain responsibilities, on unions to engage in certain forms of collective bargaining. So if the law is imposing responsibilities on the unions themselves, then the unions should be able to draw more broadly on the workforce that they're actually bargaining on behalf of. And Abood was actually quite careful in distinguishing, as Josh admirably laid out, between the kind of ideological activities that unions engage in, say, supporting the Democratic Party, which you are not allowed to charge these agency fees for, or if you do charge them, it can be reimbursed, and the collective bargaining activities that unions engage in for which these agency fees can be charged to non-members. I do see the argument on the other side, which is to say that if you go back to cases beginning with, Willie versus Maynard, the license plate case where there's an objection to forced speech on license plates, all the way through the long line of compelled speech cases, that you're forcing people to speak in certain ways when you take non-members of a union and then collect dues from them. But I think those forced speech concerns are much more attenuated once you take off the ideological speech provisions, and then leave only the collective bargaining aspects of the fees. With regard to what I think the court is going to do, Harris is the relevant precedent, again, as Josh said, and I think it's very worrisome from the perspective of those who would want to see Abood remain good law, as I do myself. As I read Harris versus Quinn, I mean, I think a fair reading is that, you know, what happened in Harris was that they distinguished it on factual grounds. So, you know, a bare majority of the court said that the employees who were affected in Harris were partial public employees rather than public employees per se. So they kind of hived off this category or subcategory of public sector employees to skirt the issue of Abood, of whether or not to overrule Abood. But if you look at the proportion of time that Alito's majority opinion in Harris spends on how wrong Abood was vis-a-vis the percentage of the opinion that it spends on this partial public employee idea, the former exceeds the latter by, you know, about, you know, at least a third, if not 50%. So, you know, I think Alito's opinion on this is really clear, and, you know, he got, you know, 5 votes for the entire opinion. So this is something that is concerning. Going back to one of the things that Josh said earlier, the Shelby County case, and we'll also see in the Fisher case, this is also classically out of the Roberts Court playbook, right, of sending a shot across the bow. And I actually do admire this because it gives people notice about what they have to argue before engaging in a categorical overruling of a case. So in the same way that we had the Northwest Austin case sort of hinting that Shelby County was on the way before Shelby County did what it did, so too could we see the Harris case as being as presaging what might be afoot in the Friedrichs case. So, you know, this might be an admission against interest, given that I like Abood, but, you know, I'm not particularly optimistic about it. If I were to have one ray of hope about it, it would be Kagan's dissent, where she underscores that one of the factors, as all of us know, in whether or not the court will overrule one of its precedents is the reliance that has been placed on the earlier precedent. So Abood dates back to 1977. And reliance interests are particularly strong, the court has said, in the realm of contracts. And so if we think about the thousands of contracts that would be affected, Kagan says, the reliance interests speak very, very loudly under the stare decisis analysis for keeping Abood as good precedent.
Interesting. Josh, so both you and Kenji agree that there may be writing on the wall for Abood, but help our listeners understand, what is the core of Justice Alito's critique? In the Friedrich briefs, the petitioner said that the union's political and non-political activities were so intertwined that it's impossible for an objecting worker to tell whether there'll be subsidizing activity they don't endorse. Is that one of Justice Alito's concerns, or are there others? And can you basically help us understand his case against Abood?
Right. So the case goes like this. When you have a public sector union and they're negotiating an increase in wages, right? Who are paying those wages? Taxpayers. When the union negotiates for an hourly concession that certain parts of employees get, you know, more hours, whatever it happens to be, who bears the brunt of that cost? Taxpayers. So the argument is actually that virtually everything that a public sector union does invariably goes back to the public fisc, and that there's no meaningful distinction between, you know, lobbying the legislature, fundraising, supporting a member of the state legislature to, you know, support the union, versus negotiating directly with the government, that effectively the public sector union is negotiating with the government itself at every single juncture, and that itself is a public act. And I think that Justice Alito sees serious compelled speech issues, as well as I think there's some freedom of association issues lurking in the background as well.
Kenji, what do you think about Justice Alito's argument, ably channeled by Josh?
Yeah, so I think it's a strong argument. You know, if I were to counter, I would say that one of the things that it might not give enough weight to that it scants is the time-old distinction between the government or time-honored distinction between the government as a sovereign and the government as an employer. You know, so we've driven that wedge in context after context, whether that's, you know, the Dormant Commerce Clause or whether that's this kind of context. So we treat the government very differently according to whether it's operating as a sovereign or a regulator and whether or not it's operating as an employer. And with regard to collective bargaining issues, it seems really clear that the government is operating as an employer rather than as a regulator. So the worry would be that if you don't see that distinction here, then it could have knockoff effects for that distinction in other areas of law. And this is a very well-settled area of law. I should also say, Jeff, before we leave this case, that there's also a fallback position in the case where the idea is that even if the court doesn't overrule Abood, there's a position that says that the opting out regime should change into essentially an opting in regime so that non-members should not have to opt out of paying fees that go to political activity, but rather should be able to sort of opt out only once and then be excused unless each individual non-member explicitly agrees to pay it. So I just want to underscore that, you know, there are two issues in this case and that there's an intermediate position, even if the court doesn't go either for overruling Abood or just retaining the status quo.
Great. Well, last beat on this, Josh, you did promise to channel Justice Kennedy in Friedrich, so how's he going to vote?
You know, Justice Kennedy didn't break off to concur separately in Harris. This is the 2014 decision. Usually when Justice Kennedy's queasy, he writes his brief concurring opinion as well, you know, I agree with the majority, but only to go so far, right? And he often does this in many cases. The affirmative action case, he does this very often. Kennedy said a minute ago he didn't break off, and he may not see any sort of, I don't know, dignity issues of being forced to join union. I don't know. And in terms of whether Justice Kennedy is interested in overturning precedents that people rely on, I think after Bergoglio, he's permanently stopped from making any stare decisis arguments ever again in terms of overturning, you know, millennia-old institutions. So I don't think he'll flinch at this case. And, you know, well, I'm usually wrong about these things, but they could rule against them, or they could take the narrow route that Kenji mentioned, just say, well, if you're a public sector employee, you opt out once, that's enough. So they may chip out Abood, but they may not kill it. But I don't think the unions will walk out of this one with a complete victory.
Thank you for that serene analysis. And that brings us to the last of our three cases, Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin. Kenji, can you tell us about the background about this fascinating and important case in the Supreme Court for the second time? Why has it come back to the court?
Sure. So this is a pretty storied case. You know, I think that we really need to go back to the Hopwood case, which was actually a Fifth Circuit case that was decided in the jurisdiction that covers Texas. And it said that racially conscious admissions policies were not permissible. And so Texas pivoted, the University of Texas pivoted to doing affirmative action by implementing what is known as the top 10% program. So it's actually the state legislature that enacted this law. And under that law, if you graduate in the top 10% of a Texas high school, you get automatic admission to the University of Texas system. And it's actually very ingenious because it relies on the segregation of the Texas high schools. So it turns a great weakness of the high schools into a great strength at the university level, because if you have a highly segregated high school system, say an all-black high school, then the top 10% of that high school is going to be black. And so that's a way of getting diversity while also getting a very meritorious students into the system. Using that top 10% program, the University of Texas was very successful in getting racial diversity. In 2003, the United States Supreme Court decided the Grutter versus Bollinger case, in which it effectively overruled the Hopwood case in saying that racially conscious admissions in a very narrowly tailored way were permissible. And in the wake of that, what the University of Texas did was to implement a layered program where it retained the top 10% program to fill about 80% of its class, but the remainder of its class it filled using racially conscious admissions. So this first came up before the court, you know, a couple of terms ago, as you mentioned, Jeff. And, you know, it was argued in October, and we were waiting and waiting for the decision, and it didn't come down until June, which betokens some kind of strife among the justices, I think it's fair to say, about what the outcome should be. And Justice Kennedy ended up writing a decision that had for seven justices, with Justice Ginsburg dissenting and Justice Kagan recused, saying, look, we're just going to kick this can down the road a little bit, because what we see the Fifth Circuit as having done wrong in upholding the, you know, bifurcated program of the top 10% program plus this racially conscious admissions program for the remaining 20% or so of students. What the University of Texas, what the Fifth Circuit below did wrong in affirming that program was that it deferred both to the end of diversity in higher education and with regard to the means used to achieve that end, namely the top 10% program plus this racially conscious admissions program. And it said, well, we defer under our prior precedents, such as Grutter, to the end that is chosen. We do not defer with regards to means. And so it kicked it back downstairs for the Fifth Circuit to take a closer look as to whether or not the means that the University of Texas was using to get its end of diversity, ethnic and racial diversity in its incoming classes was constitutionally proper. And, you know, Justice Ginsburg dissenting said, you know, this is, I think that the Fifth Circuit did exactly what we've told it to do. So this is essentially, she didn't say this, but she implied that this was simply a stalling tactic. The Fifth Circuit made the interesting decision not to remand to the district court for a trial, but instead, you know, Jeff, you know, I feel very strongly about trials, so I don't know whether that was a good decision or not, but essentially said, we think that we did this right too. So they agreed with Justice Ginsburg, surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. And so it affirmed, even under the new standard of giving deference to the end, but not to the means. And now another appeal has been taken and cert has been granted in the so-called Fisher 2 case to decide whether or not the program is constitutional. So the Supreme Court was kind of relatively parsimonious last time in saying you've applied the wrong standard, so it didn't really go deeply into the merits. But this time, I think that the merits of whether or not the program is constitutional or not are unavoidable.
Thanks for that great introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, when Kenji talked about his affection for trials in his phenomenal book, Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trials, he talks about how fact-finding by lower courts can really centrally inform constitutional analysis. Please do check it out. Josh, let us focus on the means that Texas has chosen. So this top 10% plan guarantees admission to anyone in Texas who's in the top 10% of their high school class. Because of racial geographic segregation, this ensures a certain amount of racial diversity. But the University of Texas concluded that there were many classes, especially STEM, science and technology and math classes, that didn't reflect the population of the state as a whole. So they wanted to use 20% of their admission in a more holistic process. They say that it's not about quotas, but focuses on the individual. And they say that just to limit it to the top 10% plan would support the segregation of neighborhoods and wouldn't guarantee enough diversity. I don't mean to keep focusing on Kennedy, but he is a crucial vote here. How is Justice Kennedy likely to evaluate that plan as a constitutional matter?
Well, actually, Jeff, I think the most important vote here is actually Justice Kagan, because she has no vote. Justice Kagan, as Solicitor General, advised in this case, so she's recused. We only have eight justices, and that makes for very funny math of trying to do anything. So in the event that the case, ultimately it comes down to Justice Kennedy, but in the event that, you know, you have the four conservatives and then Justice Kennedy joins the four liberals, you have what's the oddity that is the 4-4 affirm, where basically it's a tie and you affirm the lower court. So effectively what you would need is a 5-3 vote by Justice Kennedy with the conservatives. Now, a little bit of inside baseball. In her book, Joan Biskupic had a great book about Justice Sotomayor that came out about 2 years ago, and she actually had some inside baseball on this. She says that originally the reason why this case took so long to decide was that Justice Sotomayor was holding it up, that she had proposed to issue a very blistering dissent, which I think became her dissent in the Schuette case a year or two later, saying that, you know, this policy is very much necessary. It's constitutional, and that for whatever reason the court said that, okay, we'll resolve this in narrow grounds. We'll give the Fifth Circuit another bite at the apple. This is again keeping with the Roberts Court of saying, okay, we won't strike everything down right away. We'll give you another, you know, shot across the bow. I think as Kenji said a minute ago, they sent it back to the Fifth Circuit. I don't think the Fifth Circuit did what they wanted them to do. And even if it is true that Texas says they can't achieve this by other means, I don't think that will matter much to the court because, again, this is strict scrutiny. And strict scrutiny said has to be very narrowly tailored. You can't simply take the school's word for it. And that was, I think, the error the Fifth Circuit made, is that they effectively deferred to what UT said. And Justice Kennedy's opinion from a couple of years ago said, no, we don't defer. Courts will independently assess it. So even if it's true that the university won't be able to get a more diverse class, that may not be enough for the court, especially since this is round two. They've already served notice that the Fisher ruling was on the chopping block, and that they may say all you can do is do what Michigan did and stick with Justice O'Connor's 25-year prediction that we'll only need this another 12 years or so.
That's great. Both the inside baseball is helpful and also your framing of the issues. I want our audience to really understand the constitutional arguments on both sides. Kenji, can you channel both the constitutional argument for why Texas's plan is consistent with the 14th Amendment and then argue against and say why it isn't?
Yeah, so let me actually start with why it isn't, because that's the plaintiff's argument. So the plaintiff is arguing that the 14th Amendment really belongs to people as persons rather than as groups. And that means that race discrimination against a white individual, Abigail Fisher is white, is just as problematic as racial discrimination against a black person, or at least should draw the same level of constitutional scrutiny. So the people who adhere to this strict, you know, colorblindness principle include at least Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas. And Chief Justice Roberts was also saying in the Parents Involved case in 2008, which has occurred in a slightly different context, but also concerned racial distribution in schools. It was secondary and elementary schools in that case. But he said the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discrimination on the basis of race. And so he made it really clear that, I think, that he adheres to this kind of colorblindness principle as well. The argument on the other side is that, you know, these two things are actually not the same, you know, that colorblindness as a principle sounds really appealing, but that if we really look at why we have, you know, affirmative action, it is because there are, you know, underrepresented groups historically within organizations, within educational institutions. And as Justice O'Connor argued in the majority in the Grutter case, was a couple of things. One is that I think that even though the court has moved away from the remedial rationale per se of, you know, reparations for underrepresented groups, she said that, you know, the country's unfortunate history with race makes diversity on the basis of race particularly salient. So even though we're talking about the diversity rationale, I think we're oftentimes thinking that the remedial rationale is coming in, so that the diversity rationale becomes a kind of Trojan horse for the remedial rationale. And then I also think that the argument for thinking about these two contexts is different, for thinking about, you know, affirmative action is different from Jim Crow, to put it slightly polemically, would be to say that what we're really talking about here is actually bringing people together rather than pushing them apart. And so that the benefit of the diversity rationale is that if you're exposed to all kinds of diversity, not just racial diversity, but including racial diversity, that, you know, stereotypes about groups erode, you know, rubbing elbows with people diminishes prejudice against them. And this is something, this form of diversity is beneficial to everybody within the environment and not just to the people who are in the minority group. So that, you know, individuals who are white could, would benefit just as much as individuals who are not. So I would say that those are the argument. I guess a couple of reactions, really not criticisms or objections, but just reactions to a couple things Josh said. One is just an elaboration of what happens when a 4-4 happens. So when a 4-4 vote happens, the lower court is affirmed, but what the court says is no precedential value, right? So if they do a 4-4, then essentially the status quo will remain as it has been. And that's essentially the Grutter case in 2003, which created a kind of safe harbor in saying, if you're doing this for diversity grounds, diversity is a compelling governmental interest, at least in higher education, and using race as a plus factor is narrowly tailored to that compelling governmental interest in a way that would survive heightened scrutiny. And as Josh said, you know, Justice O'Connor said 25 years from now, I hope that affirmative action would not be necessary. So that was in 2003. So 25 years from then would be 2028. So even she was thinking that there would be an end, you know, state to this in which affirmative action would not be necessary. But I also want us to think about where she's getting that 25 number, which is all she did was to take 2003 and subtract the date of the Bakke case, which is 1978, which is seen as the fountainhead of affirmative action. So it's a fairly kind of arbitrary way of getting at that number. And what I take from that is that she was just trying to come up with a number of a generation, you know, that we should interpret 25 years as a kind of biblical 40, right, rather than as a 25 chronological years.
Thanks so much, Kenji, for all that. Josh, lots to respond to. First, focus on Kenji's constitutional arguments. He made a number of claims about why diversity might be good for students of both white and African-American students. What is the constitutional response to that?
So I think the Supreme Court has said, and Justice O'Connor's opinion is definitely susceptible to many readings, but that it's really diversity because of the opportunities and exposures that can provide. The idea of remedying past injustice, the idea of reparations, these are arguments that Justice Thurgood Marshall championed in a number of his opinions, but that never carried the day by the Supreme Court. So at bottom, all you're left with is how diversity contribute in institutions of higher education. And if the court finds that you can achieve the same diversity through more narrowly tailored means without such explicit use of race, then I think it's going to be hard for UT Austin to defend this policy.
Great. Well, I think it's time, gentlemen, for closing arguments. Kenji, if the court does strike down affirmative action in the Fisher case, will that mark the writing on the wall, as we've used the expression, for affirmative action more generally? And then please add any concluding thoughts you have about why this term of the Roberts Court will be significant for the future of the Constitution.
Yeah, so thank you, Jeff, first of all. This has been a really enlightening session. So first of all, just to respond, I actually agree with my colleague, Josh, that he's absolutely right. The remedial rationale has fallen into disfavor. It's not completely gone, but the rule is that a governmental entity can only engage in remedial affirmative action in order to remedy discrimination that it itself has engaged in that has continuing effects into the present. So he's absolutely right about that. What I was trying to articulate was that all of this is going to occur under the diversity rationale, but sometimes I see the diversity rationale as being a Trojan horse for kind of smuggling in concerns that sound more in remediation than not, and how the court will deal with that, I think, is an interesting question. But to move to your question, Jeff, you know, what happens if this gets struck down under the Equal Protection Clause? Is this the death knell for affirmative action? Well, not immediately. It certainly could be the thin end of the wedge, or it could be further driving in the wedge that, you know, parents involved started. But the reason that I don't think that it would immediately have ripple effects into the affirmative action landscape is that I think what the court would do, given that I don't view Grutter as being squarely in play, I think what they would say is, look, you know, Grutter is still good law, but you're doing well enough under this 10% program that you should not need this additional racially conscious program to achieve your ends. So what we're striking down is not the top 10% program, but rather this other, you know, racially conscious program that you're using, under the rubric, under the context of understanding that the top 10% program is there and is working. So if you think about the top 10% program, it's a program that only works once. I teach at a law school. You know, Josh teaches at a law school. This would not be a program that a law school could implement and go out or involve the law school as well, because colleges are not segregated in the same way that Texas high schools are segregated. Even at the college level, if you don't have segregated high schools, the top 10% program is not going to work. So the so-called race-neutral alternative, and I say so-called because, you know, it's hard for me to see that the top 10% program is so racially neutral, given that it was obviously implemented with the intent of increasing the racial diversity of the University of Texas. But let's grant that there's racial neutrality about the top 10% program that isn't present in the racially conscious program that's being used, that's being layered on top of it. If we assume that something like the top 10% program has to be viable in order for the court to be able to strike down racially conscious affirmative action, then this doesn't do damage, at least to institutions like, you know, law schools or other professional schools that can't draw on this. And it doesn't even hurt, you know, public institutions that can't do this, because their high schools, the pool that they're drawing on, is not as racially segregated as the schools in Texas are segregated. And then finally, you said, you know, is there any broad lesson to draw from this term? I'm reminded at the end of last term when, you know, we had the Obergefell case with same-sex marriage, legalizing same-sex marriage nationwide, and then we had the big Fair Housing Act case, and, you know, we had other sort of progressive cases, people saying, you know, I feel like I'm back in the Warren Court era. I feel like this is a really liberal court. Just kind of rolling my eyes and thinking, like, you know, what planet are you on? Because I don't think of this as, you know, a particularly liberal court. And I think that, you know, comparing it to the Warren Court is practically laughable. So I think that this is more of a return to type, because what I said, you know, at the time was just wait until next term when we have affirmative action, possibly reproductive justice issues, you know, cases like Friedrich's concerning non-members, you know, of public unions and the fate of public unions. Just wait until next term. So I think that this is going to be a much more quote unquote conservative term than we saw last year.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for that. Josh, last word to you. What is at stake in the Fisher case for affirmative action? And do you agree with Kenji that this, and what are your thoughts about what this term will say about the future of the Roberts Court?
Sure. So I think the aftermath of Fisher is actually another suit filed by Ed Blum and company challenging affirmative action of private institutions. We know it's black-letter law that the Equal Protection Clause only controls state institutions, but Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 has a provision that basically says you can't discriminate on the basis of race. And Justice Rehnquist's decision 30 years ago in Bakke basically said that the Civil Rights Act and Equal Protection are coterminous in terms of this. So if, in fact, the court imposes a strict scrutiny, that every single private institution which uses race quite explicitly, not holistically, explicitly, Harvard, among others, will seriously need to reconsider their admission criteria. That's the nuke, right? That's why Ed Blum is not necessarily asking to overturn Grutter here, because once you apply even Grutter, most private institutions, his clients are a bunch of Asian Americans who are saying that Harvard discriminates against Asians by making it harder for them to get admitted. He has a case at UNC Chapel Hill as well. That's the next shoe to drop. And to wrap up the term, Kenji's exactly right. I wasn't alive during the Warren Court, but I sure felt it last year. And by one measure, the New York Times said this was the most liberal term since the name of the chair that Kenji sits in, Earl Warren, sat in the middle, with cases like Obergefell on the Fair Housing case. This year will have cases involving abortion, the voting rights case. They might get rid of the fees for the public sector unions. One case which I've been keeping a very close eye on is the immigration case. I filed a couple briefs on that in the Fifth Circuit, whether the president's action in immigration is constitutional. If that one gets cert, that becomes a blockbuster overnight, because it's a massive separation of powers case with a highly charged political valence. So I'm keeping my eye open for that. But this term should be a little bit less Warren, maybe a little bit more Berger, but either would be well done.
Excellent. On that note, let me thank you, Josh Blackman and Kenji Yoshino, for an enlightening, civil, and nuanced discussion of the most hotly contested questions of the Supreme Court term, if the opinions themselves are half as thoughtful as this discussion, then the country will be in good shape.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Today's show was edited and engineered by Jason Gregory. It was produced by Nicandro Iannacci. Research was provided by Joshua Weinberg and Daniele Evans. Get the latest constitutional news and continue today's conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/constitutionctr, and on our Twitter feed, @constitutionctr. We want to know what you think of the podcast. Send your questions, comments, and suggestions to editor@constitutioncenter.org. Please subscribe to We the People on iTunes. Just search for us in the iTunes store. While you're there, leave us a review. It helps other people discover what we do, which is constitutional education. Please also subscribe to Live at America's Town Hall, a new podcast featuring conversations and debates presented here at the center, across from Independence Hall in Philadelphia. The most recent episodes feature blockbuster conversations on religious liberty in America with top scholars of constitutional law and policy leaders in Washington and beyond. We the People is a member of the Panoply Network. Check out all of our sibling podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. And finally, despite our inspiring congressional charter, the National Constitution Center is a private nonprofit. We receive little government support, and we rely on the generosity of people around the country who are inspired by our nonpartisan mission of constitutional education and debate. Please consider becoming a member to support our work, including this podcast. Visit constitutioncenter.org to learn more. And please join us again next week. On behalf of the National Constitution Center, I'm Jeffrey Rosen.